This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from the new president of Media Matters for America, Bradley Baichok. He's a person from this area. In this group, Media Matters has become one of the major watchdogs of media and politicians in this land of ours. We'll talk with Bradley Baichok about many matters regarding the media and the political environment, with Mary Landrieu seeking re-election and much more going on, with David Vitter again becoming a magnet for controversy on Capitol Hill. Also on the show, we'll talk about the production of Clyburn Park at Swine Palace, and it starts soon with an actress of renown. Laura Grice is the star of Clyburn Park, and we will visit with her. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're joined now by Bradley Baichok, a Louisiana man who is now the president of Media Matters for America, a politically progressive media watchdog group that's dedicated to comprehensively monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the U.S. media. Set up as a tax-exempt nonprofit organization, Media Matters was founded in 2004 by journalist and author David Brock. And at about that time, David Brock was on this show. So now we have a local man who is in charge of this group that has grown leaps and bounds over the last 9 years. Good morning, Bradley Baichok.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Well, you have worked with Media Matters a bit before becoming president not so long ago.
I did. I've been here about a year now, and before I had founded and started a super PAC called American Bridge that was more political in nature, also founded by David, that focused on research, tracking, and rapid response in the presidential elections, the Senate races, and a number of House races. So it's a sort of a similar model to Media Matters, American Bridge was, and very happy to be here.
Well, the political scene is, as we know, quite contentious, and we'll get to some of that. But in Washington, the story of the week has been the tragedy at the Washington Navy Yard. Story today, a month before his murderous rampage, Aaron Alexis called the police in Rhode Island to complain that he had changed hotels three times because he was being pursued by people keeping him awake by sending vibrations through the walls. Something like this, you would think, Bradley Baichok, would not involve partisanship, but there are those who try to capitalize on these tragedies. Do you think that's a part of the fabric of the political environment today?
I do. I mean, it's a sad part of it, but it's certainly one. And it doesn't take long after a tragedy like this before you hear things on both sides, people sort of overextending where the dialogue should really be. So from the right, you'll hear this is because there's a growing mass shootings because of gun-free zones, or because this is something that President Clinton did back in the 90s, that this is President Obama's fault because of X, Y, and Z. And on the left, obviously, you hear similar arguments that are sort of quickly formed and thrown into the mix. And it's a reality of sort of today's politics, when really sometimes we should just breathe and take in this tragedy and then look forward.
Where were you Monday when this happened?
I was here. I'm in Chinatown in D.C. Two and a half miles. I'm about a half a mile from the Senate building. So, but I go very often to the baseball games, and it's right down there, right next to the stadium. So, there very often. I mean, a lot of folks that work here live in that area, and weren't able to go home till later that evening. Luckily, me and the one I know was sort of affected in any tragic way. So,
well, the name Baichok is well known in Louisiana. You come from a politically active family here.
I do. My dad told me it was the family business growing up, so that's what I got into. I was lucky. My grandfather, when I grew up, was in politics, and I was fascinated to sort of just see and watch. He was Edwin Edwards' executive counsel in the early 70s. And when I grew up, my dad worked in politics and worked in campaigns, and I'd put up signs on Saturday morning hungover when I was at LSU. And you know, I was lucky enough during the summers to come up here and intern for Senator Breaux and James Carville, and I kind of got hooked. It's certainly a drug, and really enjoyed doing a lot of the local campaigns with my dad, Michael, and his partner, Trey Orso, for a number of years.
And you were involved with Congressman Charles Melanson.
I was. He was my first boss, a great man, and I worked on his first campaign in 04. We had won the closest congressional race in the country by 569 votes, and then 2006 ran his reelection, and we had a pretty tough race from Craig Romero, and then he ran unopposed in 2008, and then in 2010 we had a tough year and ran a spirited but tough race against David Vitter. It was one of the best experiences I'd ever had, was those three sort of cycles with Charlie and his wife.
David Vitter, despite his woes, has never lost a race. He's a tough competitor, isn't he?
He is. He is a prize fighter. I mean, I think, you know, you look back at the Chris John race, and he sort of took everyone by surprise by making it without having to go to a runoff. He took a signature issue on and the reimportation of Canadian drugs, and really just ran fearless, I think. And I think, again, in 2010, he ran pretty fearless. Now, you know, obviously we were in a tough year, a tough election environment, a tough electoral environment, a partisan environment. I think they took every advantage of the atmosphere they were running in, and it doesn't seem like he's letting up. I think he enjoys this combative nature like he used to in the legislature of, you know, it's like Tupac. It's like me against the world. And in Louisiana, it's him against the Obama administration. And he takes that mantle seriously.
Well, he and Harry Reid appear to be worthy adversaries. Reid is threatening to propose legislation that would involve senators who have consorted with prostitutes to be ineligible for Obamacare and ineligible for the health benefits that they currently receive. And Vitter has responded by calling Reid a desperate old-time Vegas mafia thug.
Well, they look, you know, Reid used to be a boxer, so he was a very established boxer. So he likes to fight. I think when you look at their sort of tiff, I mean, one thing about Vitter is he doesn't back down from these fights. Now, that doesn't mean that he's right in the basis of his thought. And, you know, obviously he takes full advantage of these things to his credit. So this fight, I think a staffer sort of said, hey, Vitter really pissed us off. Let's see if we can do something to tweak him. They did. They leaked it to Politico. He got word of it, and he took it head on and wrote them back and said, we want an ethics investigation, and Reid came back and said, I'll give you a vote on your amendment. So it's sort of TBD, but it's certainly two guys slugging each other. it should be interesting.
Do you think Vitter will run for governor?
I do.
And he would be a strong candidate, I would think.
He will. You know, we'll see how – I think a lot for – the governor's race in 2015 rides next year in 2014. And so, you know, for Democrats, the most important thing to do would be to reelect Senator Landrieu. And then looking forward and sort of gleaning from her race, what it would take to put the right coalition together to have a Democrat elected in 2015. But I certainly think that Senator Vitter is running full steam ahead.
297-5633 is your number. We will go to the phone lines in a moment with Bradley Baichok, the president of Media Matters for America. And Bradley is a young man in a hurry. How old are you, Bradley?
32. Somewhere.
Okay. And you're head of this major watchdog group, and I get information on a daily basis, always interesting from Media Matters. And would you characterize the media landscape as more liberal, more conservative, or about in the middle? How do you think it is
right
now? I think
the we obviously focus on conservative media at Media Matters. I think the media landscape in the past, there's been a stereotype, and it's fun to on a soapbox to say the liberal media. But what's been interesting about the way the media sort of changed is that it's diversified a little bit. So, you know, on the conservative side, it started with the Drudge Report a number of years ago, which is still one of the most widely read websites in the world. And then it continued with networks like Fox and others that have grown in prominence. So you have these websites that you can get people get a lot more of their information online, which helps for any bias in the media. It sort of balances it out. And Twitter has done a lot. I know that sounds crazy. Facebook has done a lot for how people consume news. So we have a real challenge on our hands. I mean, we certainly listen to Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Laura Ingraham, and we watch Fox 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you want to spread like misinformation, we always say the best time is between 1 and 5 a.m. because that's when we're dark. And then, you know, but in addition, there's websites out there, the Daily Caller and others that, you know, the right wing get their information from. There's certainly websites that the left wing get their information from, and our job is to take what we deem misinformation in that media outlet and correct it.
Now, your boss, David Brock, I guess he's your boss.
Yeah.
Okay. He's the founder of Media Matters. He was a guy who was a right-wing conservative, and he wrote a book about his epiphany. He became a liberal, and his friends, and they were close friends at one time, included Laura Ingraham and Ann Coulter, and suddenly he has this this epiphany that results in him changing. And this is the same man who wrote the book The Real Anita Hill. He's apologized for that book, which was an overwhelming bestseller, by the way. Brock is an interesting man, isn't he?
He gets everything you just said is true. There's no misinformation there. He then wrote a book called Blinded by the Right, to sort of talk about his experience.
That was when we talked with him. Yeah.
Yeah, and that book was sort of focused on his experience as a right-wing conservative up-and-coming journalist, and what sort of led to his conversion to more progressive, and obviously he sort of changed his thoughts and views. He started Media Matters in 2004 sort of based on that premise that there was a lot of misinformation in the media and there was nothing that was being done on the progressive side to push back on it. And it's grown to, you know, 75 or 80 folks we have here in Washington. In addition, he started the Super PAC that has a very large staff in and of itself. But look, his whole premise is he identified, I think, a weakness and a vulnerability in the progressive movement, which was how do we fight back against people that we agree were very adversarial, established foes. When Rush Limbaugh says something at 1 o'clock in the afternoon this afternoon, some congressman at 4 o'clock is going to be in a local media outlet or on Fox parroting what Limbaugh said, whether it's true or not. So some of the things Rush Limbaugh says are true, but some of them aren't. And the ones that aren't, it then permeates into the sort of ecosystem of the media, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to contain misinformation and correct it or discredit the messengers. And Limbaugh happens to be one of our likely targets for that.
Well, I mentioned Ms. Coulter, who was a good friend of David Brock at one time. On this show, he said she survived on a diet of Chardonnay and cigarettes. Here's Ms. Coulter recently talking about the President of the United States.
And since the re-election, Putin has time after time after time made Obama a monkey.
And here's what America's Newsroom co-host Martha McCullough.
All right, that's a sampling of what Media Matters does, picking out that comment from Ann Coulter. Obviously, she knew what she was doing, indirectly calling the president a monkey.
Yeah, and look, we get a lot of this. I mean, you know, there's part of it is just taking some of these things that folks say and highlighting it so that hopefully it doesn't happen again or there's some action. I mean, ultimately, we want impact. Before I got here, Media Matters did a lot with Glenn Beck. And the way that they did this was they highlighted things that were as asinine as you just played that Glenn Beck would put on his program. And they targeted advertisers that were on his program. And they
All right, hold tight. Bradley Baichok, president of Media Matters for America, will return. 297-5633. Back in 90 seconds.
I wouldn't be surprised if they delayed the start of this stupid press conference to monitor media to see what's being said so they can flavor what comes out of his mouth in this press conference in a subtle way to counter it. I guarantee you they've been monitoring this and other things being said, and they'll tailor what he's going to say in the press conference to react to this stuff. There are Republicans who criticize Obama. There are not many, but there's some who do, but he never singles.
If you talk to economists,
this has never, not once.
This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane is producing today, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Engster's show at WRKF.org by email. Bradley Baichok, the president of Media Matters for America, is with us, a man who not so long ago was a student at LSU. What was your major at LSU, Bradley?
Mass communication.
Well, that's a good one.
Yeah.
And were you a fraternity member?
I was not. I spent my free time going to LSU games, gambling, waiting tables.
All right. Where did you wait tables?
A place called Pave, which isn't around anymore, in the Goodwood Shopping Center. Mike Anderson's, which is obviously still around. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now he is running the show at Media Matters for America. Bradley says for about 20 hours a day, he and his staff listen and watch what's happening. I guess peruse editorial columns as well. But here's a sampling of something that Media Matters unearthed from Rush Hudson Limbaugh a few weeks ago when Rush was on his high horse. JC?
I wouldn't be surprised if they delayed the start of this stupid press conference to monitor media to see what's being said so they can flavor what comes out of his mouth in this press conference in a subtle way to counter it. I guarantee you they've been monitoring this and other things being said, and they'll tailor what he's going to say in the press conference to react to this stuff. There are Republicans who criticize Obama. There are not many, but there's some who do, but he never singles them out. He singles me out, and there's a reason for that. Because
now what is that?
Well, I do more than oppose him. I define him.
There's a man who has a high opinion of himself. He defines President Obama. Bradley Baichok?
Sure. I mean, Limbaugh is a brilliant, and a lot. I found that as we've grown in this space, a lot of the right wing conservative media commentators are all very good marketers. So you know, on the left, we really don't have a lot of. There is no Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh of the left that's on the radio every day. But maybe that's because we didn't go to the best marketing school. Because the thing that they do have in common, I think, Limbaugh, Beck, Hannity, Laura Ingraham, and others, is that they touch on what I see a lot as the worst in society, but they're able to drive their audience. They're putting things on their programming that is motivating their audience to get angry, to get mad, to take action. Now, I think ultimately their action part electorally has been unsuccessful. For a while it was, but the way that demographics have sort of changed, now electorally they're losing, so they're really in a pickle. Because you have sort of new stars like Marco Rubio in the Republican Party that maybe they do want to, you know, do something on immigration. But that is not what Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, or Rush Limbaugh want. And they carry a lot of influence in the Republican Party.
297-5633, your number for Bradley Baichok, president of Media Matters for America. HB in Denham Springs, good morning, HB. You're on with Bradley.
Good morning, Mr. Bradley. Just a quick comment here that I read several years ago that basically said that the most trusted broadcast news people that has never been equaled yet, according to the article, was Paul Harvey, Billy Graham, and Walter Cronkite for delivering the truth and just the truth and their opinions and commentaries, followed by Bob Woodard and John Camp for investigative reporting. Your opinion on that that information, please, sir. Thank you.
Well, go ahead, Bradley.
No, I think obviously, look, those were the sort of stalwarts of reporting. Bob Woodward, I think, lately has fallen into the crosshairs of misinformation. But among the others, I think that it's hard to disagree with that.
What's happened to Bob Woodward?
I don't know him personally, but it seems like lately, in the last 6 to 8 months, he sort of he floats things that aren't necessarily factually based. And we've seen this. He compared Benghazi to sort of Watergate, which is a sort of stretch in our imagination, being that that there wasn't a big cover-up, and that is a big right-wing, you know, sort of a right-wing talking point, if you will. And then I think another piece is a few months ago he had a he said that a White House advisor had used threatening language in an email to him regarding economic, him and Gene Sperling, the economic advisor, were talking. And then when they released these emails, it was very non-threatening and very much apologetic. So, and he sold these claims on Hannity and Fox for weeks until the sort of full truth come out. But look, it happens. I mean, I can't disagree with the guy said.
This is a study that's 6 years old, but Media Matters released a survey of 1,377 U.S. newspapers and 201 syndicated political columnists that those papers carry on a regular basis. And Media Matters reported in paper after paper, state after state, region after region, conservative syndicated columnists get more space than progressive counterparts. Do you still say that is the case?
It's getting better. I think as we talked about, the media diversifying helps with that. I think you have papers now. We do a lot with Jennifer Rubin, a conservative columnist at the Washington Post, who is a poster child for misinformation. But the Washington Post obviously has more progressive and liberal columnists also. So I think we see a little bit more now where even like a Politico will have the left and the right, like kind of like the CNN crossfire setup. You see that more often now than a singular viewpoint based on who owns the paper or what the publisher wants or, you know, who's been there the longest.
No, quite often we hear people, for example, like Mr. Limbaugh, who early on in his career would consistently close his commentaries and his broadcast by saying, never trust a draft dodger. He was referring, of course, to Bill Clinton. But here's a man who was a draft dodger in his own right. He's talked about family values. He's been married four times. He's talked about adhering to the law. He's been exposed as a drug addict. I guess the context is something that sometimes is missing. It's one thing to hear these people, but to know what's behind the voice, that's important too, isn't it?
It is, and I mean, it certainly speaks to a hypocrisy that, you know, Limbaugh is a very public figure, but he's able to sort of selectively remember what may apply to what he's sort of talking about, what he's going on that day. The Clintons have obviously been, I don't know if a figment of imagination, but certainly a real target for him for years. And that doesn't let his sort of personal piece of that come into play when he judges others, which I think is a weakness in his show or his persona.
Well, he's very popular, and he's an extremely good communicator, and this brings a question from Johanna, who asks, is it true that Congress people on the job are listening to Limbaugh to parrot his views when he goes off the air? Is that what is going on?
It is. I mean, I think when you have to look at how these things sort of happen. An example of this would be when Chuck Hagel was up for nomination a few months ago. A Republican blogger for Breitbart.com wrote an article that said he had terrorist ties to a group called Friends of Hamas. It was a terrorist organization that was anti-Israel. And this group didn't exist, but for 2 days, you know, it went from Breitbart.com to Limbaugh to Fox TV to other Republicans on the Hill. Ted Cruz, under questioning in the committee hearing, asked him about these ties. It took 48 hours for something that was made up out of thin air to make it into a confirmation hearing of a Republican U.S. senator for a position. And that goes to show you they take their cues and they take their talking points from their biggest communicators. And for right now, that's Limbaugh, that's Fox, and that's Hannity. And I think that the public is becoming more aware of these things, but they still have a very big platform.
Now, Limbaugh on one occasion called Senator Landrieu a prostitute. He was referring to, obviously, a compromise she made to get one thing. She accepted something else. Politicians do that all the time, don't they?
Right. Yeah. Well, I certainly would think that he's a buffoon for that. But it is a very common, I think you'd find a lot of Republicans or people that Limbaugh has on his show that have taken similar stands for their state, where in order for them to do what they think's needed, that the state is sort of what Louisiana would come first, or Wyoming would come first if that's mm-hmm. where you were. And if that makes you a prostitute, it's sort of, he would know.
297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org for Bradley Baichok, president of Media Matters. Cleve asks why you don't focus upon misinformation spread by MSNBC.
It's a great question. We do. And if there's misinformation on other networks, we clip it all the time. A few weeks ago, one of our notable impacts at Media Matters was David Gregory on NBC, so he's an MSNBC contributor, claimed that there were all American workers would see a Medicare tax increase as a result of Obamacare. And that's just not true. It's only individuals with incomes above $200,000 who decide to forego health coverage. So we put out an item that Sunday when he made that statement, just calling it out, not being nasty, just saying it's factually inaccurate. And the following Sunday on air, he read a correction and said, I was wrong, I misspoke. So if we've done a lot lately with CNN. If there's misinformation that we deem that is on another network or with another outlet, it's certainly not constrained to Fox. So we're open to it and monitor. Right now in my office, I have CNN, Fox, and MSNBC on the television.
But I think it's fair that you're a left-leaning organization, just as Limbaugh and others are right-leaning in their programming. Is that a fair judgment?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're a progressive organization. We look at a lot of different media. Another example recently is CNBC, which you wouldn't really think of too political, but in a sense does have a lot of programming. We're doing a lot of things around climate. And so we looked at the first half of 2013, and 51% of their coverage on climate change was sort of climate denier-ish. It was skewed against acknowledging that there could be climate change. So we put a report out about that coverage of the first year, and then in August of this year they announced they were going to have a week-long sort of special week of climate coverage that was much more sort of down the middle, fair, and balanced, which is a Fox slogan and can sometimes work. So,
Bradley, how do you see the media covering next year's election between Mary Landrieu and presumably Congressman Bill Cassidy?
I think every year that Senator Landrieu has been up for election, we've always said, like, this could be the big race, and this could be where all the national attentions could be, and this could be where the Senate's decided. I think this year is probably the one that really comes true. And so the attention, the money, the effort, the enthusiasm behind the Senate race, I think, will be immense. And she is a ferocious fighter that every year people have written, if an obituary is 500 words, they've gotten through 480 every time, and then they just salivate that they're going to write the last 20. And they've failed three times, and she's ready and going full steam ahead.
But I would imagine she'll be pounded by people like Mr. Limbaugh and Ms. Coulter. And on the other side, Congressman Cassidy will probably get criticized mightily by commentators on MSNBC.
Probably. I think what matters in these Senate races, and I think you'll see this at the end when it comes into clear focus that Louisiana, that Arkansas, that Alaska are sort of how Democrats hold on to the Senate, I think that's where you'll see some of this national media attention. But it's actually, I realized this last year at the Super PAC, we saw a little less national media interest, except when there's a big gaffe. So you know, when Todd Akin said that you just got to shut that whole, a woman's body can shut that whole thing down, it that then Limbaugh and them rushed to defend, not defend him, I'm not trying to overstate it, but they attacked the liberal media for, you know, chastising him or trying to eat him alive, and that this is just a liberal media ploy to get McCaskill elected. So the only time we've really seen the conservative media get involved in the electoral end on these Senate races are when there's something that has that sort of recognition, like a Todd Akin gaffe moment.
This election between Landrieu and her challengers is quite possibly going to end with a runoff in December of next year, though. And if that happens, that would be the only election between November and December, and conceivably could determine the balance of power in the Senate. I would imagine the media would be all over Louisiana at that point if that were to occur.
Oh, if that were to, you know, if that were to occur, all three of those TVs I told you I'm watching now would all have the segments all day about Louisiana and what's going on in Brobridge.
Yeah. Approximately how many employees do you have at Media Matters?
We have about 75 young folks.
Young folks.
Yeah.
And you're a young person, too.
Yeah, we're startup atmosphere. We're, you know, 8, 9 years old, but we still got to go get it.
All right. Jane asks, how does your organization compare with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, another organization?
They have a similar mission, just on the other side of the spectrum. So the other organization that is sort of, I don't know, comparable, but if someone said what exists in the conservative movement that's similar, Brent Bozell and the Media Research Center do a lot of beating up on liberals and progressives. I don't think as effectively or as fairly, but they certainly, there's an infrastructure on that side.
The aversion to President Obama right from the start, that's something I think that people can agree on. It's there, but is it there because of his politics, because of his race? What is causing this?
I think it could be, I mean, you'd like to think it's because of his politics. I think there's certainly elements of the public that the race is also taken into account, which is grotesque, but there, I think we've seen both instances, and I think that what we do see is that the media uses both hooks. So they know what they're doing. When Ann Coulter says these things, she knows what she's doing. She knows that she's stoking a racial flame, and then it's one that'll be good for her ratings that day and probably will get her some, she knows we'll clip it. She knows that maybe she'll get some more airtime and she'll sell a few more books. So I think both have come into play in the opposition to him, unfortunately.
Here's a question from a listener. How have the media covered the Syria controversy? Have they done a good job?
It's tough to say. I don't know how – I think it's hard when we have most of the info, but I feel like there's a lot that the public doesn't know, certainly me and organizations. So – I saw a study the other day that someone said that MSNBC was the most pro-intervention in Syria of the three networks. I didn't look too far into it. I think it was like that they covered it. There were 65% sort of in favor of intervention. So I think they did an okay job with it. I mean, I think President Obama was in a tough spot where they – it's hard to sort of have public threats and proposing action while at the same time trying to make diplomacy in other channels. And the way that this media environment now is, if Vladimir Putin, I imagine, 10 years ago...
All right, hold that thought. We'll talk about Vladimir Putin and a few other matters with Bradley Baichok when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And Bradley Baichok, president of Media Matters for America. With 75 employees, the organization started in 2004, founded by David Brock. And it peruses media outlets across the country, primarily conservative ones, and how much misinformation is there out there? You were talking about Putin a few moments ago when we went to the break. Do you think misinformation is prominent in the Syria coverage and in just about everything else that you...
I do. I think that there's very, it's unfortunate, but I think there's very few issues that you could sort of set aside and think that there wouldn't be a likelihood of someone trying to skew the debate one way or another. And that's fine. That's sort of democracy. That's debate. That's also why I think organizations like ourselves are around. The Putin thing, I thought, in terms of the Syria debate, was just interesting. Matt Drudge tweeted, Putin is the leader of the free world. Rush Limbaugh said, I'm really at a crossroads. I don't know whether to believe Putin or Barack Obama and John Kerry. And a lot of it was a sort of strange politics and makes for strange bedfellows. And they made Vladimir Putin into a right-wing sort of media star pretty quickly during the Syria coverage, where I imagine Russia and the Soviet Union aren't normally the rosy part of Fox. And so it is. It's a strange business, but it is what it is.
Well, I don't think we've talked some about Limbaugh. I don't think anybody can deny his popularity and his talent and his reach. But when you look, he's been around for several presidential elections now as a national figure, 92, 96, 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012. That's six elections. And in five of those, the Democrats have gotten more votes for president than Republicans. Could Rush Limbaugh be the Democrats' secret weapon, Bradley Baychuk?
I don't want to think about a world that tomorrow you wake up and he's just not there, because certainly I think that there's some benefits to having such a boogie monster to lift up. And, you know, with power and with reach like he sort of has comes accountability, and it's easy to hold people accountable like Rush Limbaugh for us. So I really do think that the right-wing media will have a real tough time with how to sort of correct themselves on what their politicians may be trying to move in a different direction than their media bosses want them to go.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Hopefully the first of many times with us, Bradley Baychuk, and congratulations for rising to high ranks in Washington at such an early age in life.
Thank you for the kind words. Thanks for the time.
Take care. See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now we're joined in studio by Lara Grice, an accomplished actress who is in our midst, not only in the studio, but she'll be on stage at Swine Palace over the next few weeks. And it all starts tonight with Clyburn Park. Hi, Lara.
Hi, Jim.
You've been around for a little while and have been on stage with Swine Palace before.
I have, yeah. It's nice to be back.
You played Mary Magdalene,
didn't you? I did.
That was in Jesus Christ Superstar. That was a few years ago, but... The productions are always good, aren't they?
They are. Top of the line. Louisiana's professional theater company, is it not? Swine Palace?
What's your background other than Swine Palace? So you were from where?
New Orleans.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a New Orleanian, born and raised. Lived in New York and Los Angeles, but New Orleans is my home. I was more comfortable in my skin there, and as a result, just worked more.
Well, when you're from New Orleans, you're exposed to the arts at an early age, aren't you?
Truly. Yeah, I was at Le Petit Theater, which they just renovated downtown with the Brennan's Restaurant Group. That was my first season subscription, I'm told, as a toddler, to see the Children's Corner productions. So, yeah, it's been a part of my life for some time.
Well, Clyburn Park was a big hit in New York.
Yeah, it's a wonderful play. It's extraordinary. It takes place in two acts. The first act is in 1959 in this Chicago suburb in a house with a family that is getting ready to move. And during the course of the act, you find out why. And then we have an intermission with an incredible stage crew and set, and it changes to 50 years later. We're in the same house, same actors playing completely different characters, And then the issues from 50 years ago seem to resurface again in 2009. So it's been a joy.
The play was a response to A Raisin in the Sun.
It was. I think, you know, there's one character in the play that is actually literally Bruce Norris, the playwright, pulled from Raisin in the Sun and kind of put in here to tie it together. But it's almost like an updated version in that way. But it explores, you know, more issues that have arisen within the last 50 years.
Well, the Washington Post describes Clyburn Park as a modern twist to the issues of race and housing and aspirations for a better life. Does that size it up about right?
I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly right. I mean, it does. It explores race and it explores the idea of property and community and what defines a community and who defines a community. Does a community define itself? Mm-hmm. Is there someone else that does it? Gentrification. It's a lot of really big topics and issues that are explored mm-hmm. with a little bit of heart and humor.
Which character do you play, Lara?
I play, in the first act, I play Bev.
Okay.
And she's the matriarch of the house and getting ready to leave a typical 50s suburban housewife. And in the second act, I play a real estate lawyer, a ball buster, if you will, named Kathy, who comes in and is representing the people who come back to try to remodel that new home.
We're visiting with the accomplished actress who will be on stage tonight, Lara Grice.
That's right. Tonight, Thursday, Friday, no show Saturday. Go Tigers. Sunday, and then we take a break Monday and run all next week, Tuesday through Sunday. I do encourage you to come to see it. It's a wonderful play. It's a wonderful cast and crew and a mm-hmm. great company.
297-5633 if you'd like to join us in our remaining time with Lara Grice. She plays Bev. Grieving parents Bev and Russ are planning to sell their home in the white middle-class Chicago neighborhood of Clyburn Park. They receive a visit from their local clergyman as well as a neighbor and his deaf pregnant wife. The neighbor informs them that the family buying the house is black and pleads with the couple to back out of the deal for fear that area property values will fall if black residents move in. That's a storyline that's as pertinent today in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, as it was in Chicago in 1959.
And that's just the first act.
That's just the first act. Why is it that we don't want black folks living close to white folks, particularly white folks, the majority race? Why is that?
Oh, well, I mean, that's an issue that's, you know, worth thinking about and discussing. I think that some traditions and ways of living are just different, and there's differences in community. I don't think that it's necessarily something that one doesn't want. It just might be out of fear of not understanding another's culture and way of life.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm told some of the historical events that are in Clyburn Park, Lara,
yes,
are based on reality, on things that have actually happened.
Yes, I mean, it is, it's just similar, like we said, to Raisin in the Sun, when, you know, a family of another race comes in and sort of, with just their appearance, threatens people's comfortability and what they're used to. And, you know, the fear of the unknown always puts people on the defensive. So it just sort of opens up that dialogue. And in Act Two, the tables are turned, and it's an all-black community, and a white family is coming in to buy the property, which has now become predominantly African-American. And they have the folks living there have a problem with what they're going to do with the house and, you know, pretty much knock it down and raise it 15 feet higher than the rest of the neighborhood. And that is something that everybody has a concern about. You don't want to be the biggest house on the block, do you?
Do you think about the social implications when you're doing a play like this?
Certainly. I mean, definitely in the rehearsal process, it's nice to have some food for thought that informs a performance, and also for the audience to come away with something that, you know, just wasn't entertainment, but sort of invokes a dialogue and a discussion to maybe, you know, being a little more open-minded about a situation that you're personally going through, perhaps.
Is it one of the more challenging roles you've had?
It has been a challenge for me, but it's, and for that reason, people always ask, well, what was your favorite role? Huh? And it's always the one you're doing. And I would say that that is true for this, for sure.
Well, I mentioned Mary Magdalene. What are some of the other roles you've been in that you remember vividly?
Oh, well, let's see. Well, at Swine Palace, we did the Rocky Horror Show. Uh-huh. 2 years in a row, and I played Janet in that, and then also Angels in America.
Yeah,
we did that as well. Harper, just did God of Carnage, which is wonderful, with Spud McConnell down in New Orleans, and then television roles. Whatever you know, whatever role they give me, I'll just embrace.
Which do you prefer, the stage or the small screen or the big screen?
I will say yes to all three. I'm raised on the stage. That's where my training's from, and I think that it makes for, you know, better film and television acting. But it's they're all different mediums. You know, wouldn't mind having a radio show. Need a
well,
sidekick, Jim?
You've got a nice voice.
Well,
maybe we'll start doing this together.
Okay. Is that duly noted in the producer's booth?
I think he's taking notes. But you're pretty good at what you do, and you keep late hours, so it might be tough to get in here early in the morning and get ready
I was
show.
Here an hour early listening to that wonderful interview of MediaWorks. That was great.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And
good to be here.
You've won some awards.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, you know, in the New Orleans, the theater community, mm-hmm. They have what they call the Big Easy Awards.
Yeah.
So I'm a Big Easy. And then we have a Marquee Award, and that's voted on by fellow actors and so forth. So, it's quite nice.
All right. Well, I have a question here from Lisa, who wants to know about the cast.
Sure.
For Cliburn Park.
Yeah. It's myself and then our other... six castmates are wonderful students, LSU MFA acting students.
I bet they are good.
They are. And there's a wide range of diversity and ages, and it's been a pleasure. Billy Green,
yeah.
Ashley Adams, yeah. Colton Neidhart, Amar Atkinson, Corey Crew.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know all those names. You've been getting ready for a little while, haven't you?
Yeah. We've been rehearsing since the end of August.
Do you recall your first role?
It's funny you ask that. Actually, it was a long time ago in the 80s, the first time I had ever had a speaking role, it was The Ghost of Christmas Past.
Yes.
In Scrooge or something. And I remember my dialogue, it was a musical, and my dialogue was written over a score. And I interpreted that to be that's how long. So everything I said, yeah, I learned the hard way that... you know, there's always a first Shakespeare role, a first musical role, first drama role, first television role. I remember them all fondly and hope that there's as many to come.
I'm sure there will be.
Oh, well, you're hired.
Lara is quite a striking presence, so you'll get to see her and hear her on stage starting tonight. If you'd like more information about the play and tickets and that sort of thing, 578-9277, 225-578-9277. For Cliburn Park. Who's the director?
Femi Yuba, Dr. Femi Yuba, and his assistant director, Evelyn. And it's been quite an experience.
I'm sure it
has.
Worth
coming out. And tonight's the pay what you can afford. So if you have nothing to do on this Wednesday, please come out.
Showtime is
7:30 p.m. One intermission.
That's
plenty of parking.
Swine Palace. Now, You're from New Orleans, as we know. You still live there, don't you?
I do, yes.
Yeah. Where did you go to school?
I went to high school at the Academy of the Sacred Heart, Sacré-Cœur, on St. Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went away to college in Dallas.
Where?
And University of Dallas in Irving.
Oh, so it's a Catholic university.
Small, private Catholic university. Yep.
Good school?
Very.
Yeah. But you came home.
I did. I came home, and then I went away, and then came home and went away. And then there was a lot of opportunities, starting with the film and television, that the tax incentive brought down,
mm-hmm.
Thanks to our then Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu, who's now our mayor.
I am aware of that.
Responsible for, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of those things that have stayed into play and kept us New Orleanians and Louisianians in our hometown working and making a living.
Well, how does the stage at Swine Palace and the audience, how do they compare with other places you performed?
Well, this is the first time back in the Shaver Theater for me where it was renovated. We were at the Riley for Superstar. And, you know, I don't know. It's been a little absence for me, and we'll see.
Well, are you nervous?
Should I be?
No.
Having a good time, and I hope everybody will, too.
I'm sure we will. And it sounds like a great production with Lara Grice front and center. Cliburn Park is the production. Thank you.
Hope to see you there, Jim.
That's a deal. And we'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.